Today's Veterans Radio program is dedicated to all the descendants of the General Society of the War of 1812.
Live from the Veterans Radio Studio and the Ave Maria Network in Ann Arbor, Michigan, this is Veterans Radio. And now, here's your host, former Chief Warrant Officer, Dale Throneberry.
And good morning, America, and welcome to Veterans Radio. This is Dale Throneberry, and I have the honor of being your host this morning, coming to you live as Matt mentioned, from the Veterans Radio studio at WDEO in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and around the world at veteransradio.net. Now, normally on Veterans Radio, we have veterans from various organizations or conflicts and wars in the past, but today we're kind of dedicating ourselves to a war that aren't too many survivors left, and that's the War of 1812. And we're going to be talking in just a moment with one of the park rangers from the Fort McHenry Museum, down in Baltimore, Ohio, and that's going to be Jim Bailey. We are also awaiting a call from Aaron McCord. And Aaron, I'm sorry I didn't get you the phone number in time, but Aaron is with the New Jersey State Library Talking Book and Braille Center, and they are a Veterans Preference public library that serves the blind, visually impaired, and anyone who cannot hold the pages of a standard book. And they are putting together a special program for veterans in New Jersey and throughout other states, of course, that have state library programs for talking books and braille centers. For more information on that, you can go to www.njsltbbc.org. That's njsltbbc.org. And if we can get Erin on the phone, we will bring her on the air to talk more about that. It's a great program, and I was talking with Erin earlier this week, and she had mentioned that they're hoping to put some of the Veterans Radio's programs up on their site so that the people in New Jersey can listen to them whenever they want to. Now, of course, anybody out there, you can listen to all of our archived programs at veteransradio.net and click on Archives, and they're all right there. It's 4 years' worth of programming. I think it's going to be a great opportunity for everybody, and I'm excited that we can provide that service to you. And we want to remind you out there, if you have anybody that you would like to have on Veterans Radio or a story that you think that our audience would be interested in listening to, you can just go to veteransradio.net, click on Contact Us, and we promise we'll get back to you as soon as we possibly can to bring your story on the air. We've been very fortunate. We've had the Library of Congress recently contact us to carry some of our programming in their archives. So 7 years of hard work, it looks like it's finally paying off, folks, and we're very excited again about that opportunity. We're going to, each week on Veterans Radio, we welcome home our troops. We don't have a specific unit this week, but we do want to say welcome home from Veterans Radio and a grateful nation for all that you do overseas. If it wasn't for you, none of us would be here. So on behalf of a grateful nation and all of us at Veterans Radio, welcome home.
You have honorably served the United States and the Marine Corps in times of peace and war. Now we would like to serve you. The Marine Scholars Program covers the total cost of attending Ave Maria University. By combining resources from the Ave Maria University Marine Scholars Funding, federal financial aid entitlements, and the GI Bill, the benefits are granted for the duration of the recipient's study at Ave Maria University, contingent upon good conduct and good academic standing. The Marine Scholars Program is open to all reserve and active component Marines and other combat veterans of Operation Enduring Freedom and Operation Iraqi Freedom who have honorably served our country. Please visit us online at www.avemaria.edu or call the Assistant Director of Admissions at 239-280-2552. You helped us. Now let us help you. Semper Fi.
And many of you will recognize that tune, and we all think it came from the Revolutionary War. But from my understanding and my delving into the history of the War of 1812, that was a song that was carried over from the Revolution and was used at the beginning of the War of 1812. We are going to be looking at the history of the War of 1812 right now, and joining me on the line is Jim Bailey, who is... Jim, I'm going to ask you to give us your official title there at Fort McHenry.
Well, good morning, Dale. My official title is United States Park Ranger at Fort McHenry National Monument and Historic Shrine, the only national monument and historic shrine in the entire National Park Service.
Wow. There we go. That sounds very impressive to me. We're talking then with Jim Bailey, an official United States Park Ranger. For those of you out there that want to give us a call today, you can do that at 877-573-7825. That's 877-573-7825. We'll get you on the air and you can ask Jim questions, because we're going to be looking at the War of 1812, specifically at the Battle of Fort McHenry, and then we're going to take a look at the Star Spangled Banner and a little history of that as we go on through the program. So, Jim, I guess the first question I have for you is, how in the world did this War of 1812 get started?
That's a great question, and the causes of the War of 1812 are really one of the big reasons that the war is often called the Forgotten War, because they're so complicated. The American Revolution, it's no taxation without representation, and we want independence. With the Civil War, it's, states' rights and slavery. But with the War of 1812, the causes were much more complex and built up over several years, but I suppose you could boil it down to the slogan of the time, which was free trade and sailors' rights.
Oh.
It's kind of like Wilson in World War I saying freedom of the seas. That's what we wanted in the early 1800s.
Well, and I know that there was, some people call this the Second American Revolution and kind of the rebirth of the country, but can you tell a little bit about what the British were supposedly guilty of?
Well, British warships were stopping American merchant vessels, not American warships, but American merchant vessels, and seizing their cargoes and seizing not only British deserters serving on American ships, but American civilians as well. And as you might imagine, we didn't think this was a good idea. And by the time of 1812, the British had seized well over 6,000 American citizens to forcibly serve on board British warships in their war with France. And that was one of the reasons that the British were doing this, is they're engaged in a war over in Europe against France and Emperor Napoleon and his allies. And so Great Britain is desperate for men and supplies. And unfortunately, they were able to do this to the United States because we just didn't have a large army or navy to stop them.
Well, I understand that there were some American entrepreneurs out there that were helping out the French. There was a little pirating going on.
Well, that was the other problem, is that the United States in the early 1800s saw this European war as a way to make a quick buck, and so we were supplying not only the British, but also the French. And as you might imagine, the French were really cool with us supplying them, but they didn't want us giving anything to King George III in Great Britain, and vice versa. Great Britain was pretty cool if we sold them stuff, but didn't want us giving anything to the French. And so both sides said, you can trade with us, but not the other guy. It's a proverbial rock and a hard place. No matter who you do business with, you've upset somebody else. And in this case, you're upsetting a superpower of 1814. So actually, both the French and the British were stopping ships and seizing men, but because of Great Britain's huge navy, they did more of it. And as you mentioned before, we call this the Second War of Independence. We always looked at Great Britain as the traditional enemy and France as the traditional ally. So no matter what Great Britain did, we would always look at it in a very negative light, and whatever France did in a very positive light. So we felt, hey, we declared our independence from you in the Revolution. Why are you stopping our ships? Why are you taking our men? That's not cool. That's not what you do to a sovereign nation that you're not at war with. So in many respects, it was the War of 1812 was finishing up some unresolved business from the American Revolution.
For our audience here, we're talking with Jim Bailey, park ranger at Fort McHenry, a United States National Park Service ranger, I want you to know. But the point is, I want to try to get our audience to understand how widespread that this war was. It wasn't just, you know, Washington, D.C. and Baltimore and that area. There was also concerns about what was happening out here in Detroit for our local audience. We had a few Indians that were causing a little uproar in the local area, and that war was out here as well. Is that correct?
Yes. One of the things we're really excited about with our new visitor center here at Fort McHenry is we have exhibits on the entire war, which shows visitors just how widespread it was, all up and down the Atlantic coast, in the Gulf Coast, and throughout the Great Lakes, in New York, Ohio, Indiana, Illinois, Michigan, and Upper Canada. And Detroit was the scene of the first major engagement of the war in August of 1812. We declare war in June, but it's not until August that things really get ramped up, and they do so way out on what was then the Western frontier. And there was a fort at Detroit that the British surrounded. And even though the American forces inside Fort Detroit outnumbered the besieging British, we surrendered. It was one of the worst surrenders and one of the darkest days during the War of 1812. But the British commander was very smart. You know, he marched his men in circles.
Hello? Okay, I think we need to reestablish contact here. It sounds like we lost a line there for some reason. So we're going to be getting back to Jim Bailey right now, and it looks like I'm on my own. So I'm going to talk a little bit about, this has just been one of those great programs, folks. We're having a great time here. Give us a call if you'd like to talk about the War of 1812, 877-573-7825. We were talking with Jim Bailey, who's a park ranger down at Fort McHenry, just right outside of Baltimore, Maryland. And the idea here is that we want to talk about what were the causes, well, we've already done this, we talked about the causes of the War of 1812, and then we want to get into what was happening around the Baltimore-Washington area. For those of you that are history buffs, you can understand that. They tried to, the English came up the Potomac, and they ended up burning Washington pretty much, not to the ground, I'm surprised, but did a lot of damage there. And so we're going to be talking about that as we go along, and we're also going to be listening to some versions of the Star Spangled Banner, which, of course, Francis Scott Key, who witnessed the battle at Fort McHenry when he came up in the morning and our flag was still there. Well, you know the words, and we can go forward from that. And then I've got Teresa Sloat on later on, who in the program, whose version of the Star Spangled Banner you've heard on Veterans Radio a couple of years ago, I believe, and it's just a haunting version of it, and it's very, very powerful. In the meantime, we're going to be trying to get contact back with Jim, and we do, all right? And Jim, we've got you back, correct?
Hey, Dale, yeah, you got me.
Okay. Well, I'm not sure what happened there. It must have been that old. You guys need to get new phone lines down there.
Well, you know what? They had the same kind of communication problems back during the War of 1812. It took so long to send a message from Washington, D.C. out to the Western frontier that by the time you got your orders, they were weeks old.
Yeah,
so they really didn't hear about the surrender of Fort Detroit until mid-September of 1812.
Well, we also know that even when the War of 1812 was over, there was still this major battle down in New Orleans.
Yes, the peace treaty was signed on December 24th of 1814, but back then it took about 5 weeks to cross the Atlantic. So they sent multiple copies and multiple ships with the understanding that the war would continue until a ratified copy of the treaty had been given to British diplomats in Canada. And so the Battle of New Orleans, which happened on January 8th, 1815, took place after the treaty had been agreed upon, but before it was ratified and made official.
Well, you know, modern technology.
It's an awful war.
Well, you know, we would. I wonder what would have happened at that time with Jackson if he hadn't had his great battle down there.
Well, I can tell you that Johnny Horton wouldn't have won a Grammy in the 1960s for his Battle of New Orleans song.
I know that. That's rushing through my head right now, and probably many of the listeners who are the same age. I can remember driving down south when I was, I guess, probably in high school or something, and my father and I were singing the Battle of New Orleans. So,
it's a shame, as you mentioned with Jackson, it's a shame that it's called the Forgotten War, because it gives us so many great American heroes, like Andrew Jackson, who defeated the British at New Orleans, Oliver Hazard Perry, the great naval hero, who won the Battle of Lake Erie,
mm-hmm.
Isaac Hull, who beat the British out on the high seas in the USS Constitution, and then, of course, our own Major George Armistead that helped give birth to our national anthem here at Fort McHenry.
And that's a great segue right into that. So at Fort McHenry, tell me what happened back there in that 1814.
Well, it was the third year of the war. The national economy was in a shambles. The treasury was broke. The United States as a people were bitterly divided. We were literally on the verge of internal collapse, and that's when that war in Europe ended, and the British sent massive reinforcements over to the United States. And in August of 1814, about 50 warships and 4,000 battle-hardened British veterans entered the Chesapeake Bay. They attacked and burned Washington, D.C., and then set their sights on Baltimore. So on the morning of September the 11th, 1814, 50,000 American civilians in Baltimore looked downriver and saw this massive juggernaut sailing up the river. And the only thing standing in the way of that fleet burning down the city of Baltimore was Fort McHenry.
And how big is Fort McHenry?
It's not that large. The park today is 40 acres. The fort itself probably sits on about two or three of them. It's small as forts go. And when you walk up on the top of the walls, the ramparts, or in the parade ground, you just marvel that 1,200 men were inside that fort being bombarded for 25 hours.
I think that's an amazing story in itself, because the fort itself is, in doing some research, is a traditional star-shaped fort.
Mm-hmm. Correct. Yep.
And
we didn't reinvent the wheel here. We're doing when we built Fort McHenry in 1798 to protect Baltimore, we looked at what they were building over in Europe. We said, hey, that works, and that's what we built here.
Well, and that's what you guys have been rebuilding over the years. So tell me now, we've got these ships in the harbor, we've got Fort McHenry between those ships and Baltimore, and 25 hours of bombardment. It's unfortunate that we don't have our webcasting up yet, because I really did a lot of research for photographs and found one of those bombs that they were throwing up, and almost like catapulting some of these huge bombs up onto Fort McHenry.
Well, the British had five special bomb ships that had these giant 13 and 10-inch mortars, which work just like a modern mortar would, high-angle fire, and they shoot a 13-inch, 200-pound exploding shell. So that 200-pound shell is 2 inches thick and packed with over 8 pounds of gunpowder. It's a timed fuse, and if the British have done everything just right, that 200-pound bomb should explode directly over the heads of the American defenders about 10 to 15 feet in the air. So you now have 200 pounds of iron ripping down as shrapnel, and that's what Francis Scott Key meant when he wrote the bombs bursting in air. And then the British also had these giant rockets that also exploded and left a red glare across the sky.
See, folks, you listen to this program, you learn a lot of important things.
Well, all you got to do is read the national anthem. I mean, Key puts you in the moment. Imagine being one of those 50,000 civilians. You're standing up on your roof, and you're watching this battle unfold 2 miles away. You've got a ringside seat, and you know that the minute the battle is over, the fate of your city has been decided. Whether or not you're going to go to sleep in your house that night, whether or not you're going to have a job to go to tomorrow morning, whether or not the city of Baltimore will be burned to the ground. And so you are desperate to know at dawn's early light, after that 25-hour bombardment, who won. And, you know, in 1814, Major George Armistead isn't sending out a tweet or updating his Facebook status. So the only thing you're going to, the minute you're going to know who won is when you see whose flag is flying over the fort. So 50,000 people are waiting and asking the same question. Oh, say, can you see at dawn's early light? During the battle, they knew the flag was there, even though there was all that smoke and then the darkness of night and the rain, because the attack was still going on. That's what Key says.
Right.
The rocket's red glare, the bombs bursting there gave
proof.
Proof through the night that the flag was still there. But at dawn's early light, who had won? So imagine waiting an hour and a half to find out whether or not a foreign army and navy were going to make their way into the inner harbor and destroy the city. So you can only imagine their relief at seeing that giant star-spangled banner flying over the fort.
Tell me about the flag. The story of the flag I found really interesting also.
Well, it's huge. And the amazing thing is we still have it in the American
right.
History Museum in Washington, D.C. Major George Armistead ordered the flag in the summer of 1813. It was delivered in August of 1813. And he said, I want a flag so big the British will have no difficulty seeing it from a distance. And he ordered it from Mary Pickersgill in Baltimore, who was a flag maker. And so she didn't have exact dimensions, but she figured, well, the Chesapeake Bay is 8 miles away downriver from Fort McHenry. That's the first opportunity the British will have to see it. So it needs to be pretty big. She made a flag, Dale, that was 30 feet in height and 42 feet in length, and it took her over 5 weeks to make, by hand, with over a million stitches.
And this was a 15-star, 15-stripe flag, correct?
Correct. That's what's unique about it. It's not just the size, but the design. It's our second American flag, so we've added Vermont and Kentucky to the flag, and Vermont and Kentucky got a star and a stripe. It's the only time our flag has had more than 13 stripes.
Well, it would make sense because we'd have 50 now, and it would be a really big flag, still a big flag.
Well, you're right. Early on, they figured, well, the first flag had a star and a stripe for each state. Why
That's
not
right.
the second flag? But after the War of 1812, when they had to add 5 new states, Congress took a step back and said, well, wait a minute. We've got the Louisiana Territory. We're going to be expanding westward. This might get a little out of hand. So in 1818, they decided to go back to 13 stripes.
Oh, okay. For those of us in Michigan, because we became a state in 1817, I believe, and probably Ohio, Illinois, Indiana, and all the rest of them weren't too far behind or in front of us.
No.
I think that's a fascinating story to me, because that flag wasn't cheap either in those dollars.
No. Mary Pickersgill made 2 flags for Fort McHenry, a big flag, 30 by 42 feet, and a slightly smaller flag that was still large, 17 by 25 feet, to fly in bad weather. And the 2 flags together cost $500. In 1813.
I was going to say, all you math wizards out there, you know, put that into today's dollars for a flag. I felt that story was really fascinating to me. Go ahead.
The modern flags that we fly are made out of nylon, and they're machine stitched, and they cost a giant 30 by 42 foot recreation machine stitch made out of nylon runs about $2,000. The cost of a authentic reproduction, hand stitched, made out of the finest wool bunting, would probably run in the tens of thousands of dollars. And Mary Pickersgill did such a good job on that original flag, it withstood the bombardment, and we still have it. That's the neat thing, Dale, is you can go to Washington, D.C., and see the original Star-Spangled Banner. You can come up and walk the ramparts over which those bombs and rockets exploded, the ramparts that defended the city of Baltimore. And in our new visitor center, you can see the original handwritten copy of those immortal words written by Francis Scott Key. We have the original Star-Spangled Banner song as well.
Well, I think it's just amazing what you're doing down there. And we've got about 5 minutes to go before we take a break at the bottom of the hour, Jim. We're talking with Jim Bailey, Park Ranger at Fort McHenry, and we're talking about the War of 1812 and the birth of the national anthem. And if you want to get in on the conversation, you can give us a call if you'd like to. We're still waiting for our webcast to go up. We're still working on it. So for all you techies out there, we apologize for that today. But we will... we'll get it up there sometime, because we have many pictures to go along with what Jim is talking about as far as what happened at Fort McHenry. So the War of 1812 ends in officially after the Battle of New Orleans, I guess, in 1815, correct?
February of 1815. Mm-hmm. One thing I learned in my history class in my citizenship class in high school is that the Senate confirms and ratifies all treaties. And so in February of 1815, as soon as that treaty arrives in Washington, D.C., the Senate takes a look at it. They pass it, and it goes right to the president, President James Madison, for his signature. So February of 1815 is when the war ends. So really, the War of 1812 is a misnomer. It was the War of 1812, 13, 14, and the first 2 months of 1815.
Absolutely. And there's so many other stories that we can't even get into about, you know, Dolly Madison saving all of the, you know, the artwork and furniture at the White House and some of the other things that went on. You were mentioning some of the generals and so forth. So the War of 1812 is over. We'll get into talking a little bit more about Francis Scott Key in the next section. What happened to Fort McHenry next?
Well, Fort McHenry instantly, obviously, became incredibly famous for its defense and continued to be used as a military installation up to the Civil War, when, ironically, it was called upon to keep order in the city it was originally built to protect. During the Civil War, Baltimore and Maryland were very divided in their loyalties. And so Fort McHenry actually turned many of its heavy guns on the city to maintain order and to help keep the state from seceding and joining the Southern Confederacy. It held about 23,000 Confederate prisoners of war and about 2,000 prisoners of state, American civilians that had been arrested and suspected of disloyalty or aiding and abetting the enemy, were imprisoned here.
Okay, and that was during the Civil War, and then
correct.
Did it kind of fall into disrepair after that?
Yeah, after the Civil War, obviously the garrison was drawn down pretty far, and it limped along with a few caretakers until World War One. And during World War One, of course, all the fighting is overseas, so there's no need for the fort to be a massive defensive operation, but it's got all this great real estate right by the water. So the largest military hospital in the United States was built at Fort McHenry for returning veterans. And it's at Fort McHenry, General Hospital No. 2, that the Veterans Administration really has its genesis. You've got all these veterans who have been stabilized in Europe who are being brought back to General Hospital No. 2 at Fort McHenry for long-term care and rehabilitation. And while they're there, a lot of the nurses and the doctors and the military authorities said, well, you know, how can we help these men when they get back into civilian society? Because maybe they made a living working with their hands and they lost an arm in the trenches. Or they, you know, they can no longer speak due to mustard gas, or they're blind, or the skill that they had before the war no longer works for them because of their disability. And so they had classes here that taught many of the veterans new skills, so that when they finally were discharged, they were able to get right back into the thick of things. But that hospital was temporary and torn down in 1925 when we became a national park. And the Rangers took over, and man, we were really excited to give tours and talk about Fort McHenry's history. And we were so excited that we didn't look at the fine print of the act that created us as a national park. And the fine print said that in case of a national emergency, Fort McHenry and its grounds would revert back to the War Department. So in January of 1942, there was a knock at the door saying, well, you park rangers can still give tours of the ramparts and all that, but we need the grounds again as a base. And in World War II, it was a massive
I need to cut in real quickly. We're going to talk about that on the other side. We'll be right back. You're listening to Veterans Radio.
The Medal of Honor is the highest award for valor in combat given a member of the Armed Forces of the United States. There have been over 3,400 recipients of the nation's highest award. This is one of them. Private Charles Barker volunteered to cover the withdrawal of his patrol, sacrificing himself for their safety. Details after this.
Attention all veterans in Northeast Ohio and the Midwest. Coming up on May 21st, 22nd, in Hudson, Ohio, at the home of U.S. Wings, there's going to be a rally welcoming home all Vietnam veterans. They're honoring the 50th anniversary of the beginning of the Vietnam War. And you can go to the U.S. Wings website to find out more information. This is going to be a welcome home Vietnam War 50th anniversary rally, May 20th through 22nd, at the U.S. Wings headquarters in Hudson, Ohio. Find out more information by going to uswings.com.
While participating in a combat patrol engaged in screening an approach to Pork Chop Outpost, Barker and his companions surprised and engaged an enemy group digging emplacements on the slope. Totally unprepared, the hostile troops sought cover. After ordering Barker and a comrade to lay down a base of fire, the patrol leader maneuvered the remainder of the patrol to a vantage point on higher ground. Barker moved to an open area, firing his rifle and hurling grenades on the hostile positions. As enemy action increased in volume and intensity, mortar bursts fell on friendly positions. Ammunition was in critical supply, and the platoon was ordered to withdraw into a perimeter defense preparatory to moving back to the outpost. Voluntarily electing to cover the retrograde movement, he gallantly maintained a defense and was last seen in close hand-to-hand combat with the enemy. Barker's unflinching courage and supreme sacrifice enabled the patrol to complete the mission and effect an orderly withdrawal to friendly lines. The Medal of Honor series is a production of Veterans Radio.
Sit down again. Oh, I get, man, I have goosebumps every time I listen to that. We're talking with Jim Bailey, the park ranger at Fort McHenry's Museum, and I guess in the studio, and everybody can see eyes are watering, and just what a powerful song, Jim.
It is. The depth and the symbolism of that song are amazing, and the reason for it, I think, is because it comes in after the heat of battle. And it's inspired. He doesn't sit down and deliberately think about, I'm going to write this song. It flows out of him. And when you have a moment like that of inspiration that captures a specific joyful moment, you can't top that. No matter how long you sit at your desk and try to come up with a new song, you studied effort cannot overcome inspiration. And I would compare it to Joe Rosenthal's photograph at Iwo Jima.
Right.
He didn't set everything up. You know, he took that photograph from the hip as the flag was going up. He wasn't even sure if he got it. And that moment just happened so quickly, and yet it is the most iconic photograph in the world. And that's really what our national anthem is. It's a verbal snapshot of that moment when that giant 30 by 42 foot American flag is raised in victory over the ramparts of Fort McHenry. The British fleet is sailing away in defeat, and 50,000 Americans are up on their rooftops cheering and shaking the city because they realize that we've won. And that's why Key's words become so popular so quickly, is he wrote down not only what he was thinking, but what an entire city thought and felt.
And it's just so powerful. And then, you know, where did the music come from?
The music had actually been around for over 20 years. And ironically enough, the music came from Great Britain, London, England to be exact, from a gentleman's club. It was called To Anacreon in Heaven. And you know how some clubs or organizations have a secret handshake or a special hat or uniform? The Anacreonic Society had a song that they began their meetings with, and it was so popular that here in the United States we were singing it, and Francis Scott Key knew it. In fact, after the Tripolitan Wars, he tried to write a song set to that tune about Stephen Decatur, the great naval hero, called When the Warrior Returns. It didn't really catch on. It wasn't really all that popular, but Key was very familiar with the tune. So you know how when you're driving down the road or moving around the house in the morning, a song just kind of randomly pops into your head and you're whistling it or singing it before you even realize it?
Mm-hmm.
I think that was Key with Anacreon in Heaven. And in that moment of victory and triumph, as his heart rejoiced, that tune just popped into his head as he was writing down his thoughts and feelings, and they were one. A lot of people ask, well, when was the poem set to music? And the answer is the minute it was written.
Right.
As when it was first published in Baltimore, it was set to music, and when Key wrote it, he had that tune in mind.
You know, I know that at that time, of course, we didn't have any technology at all, because or the photographs or anything along the lines. I wonder how many copies of this of the song were sold as sheet music?
Well, the first thing they did was print it up as a handbill, which is kind of like a photocopy of 1814, mm-hmm. where they had the words on a sheet of paper, and it didn't have the music. It just gave the tune. It said, to the tune of Anacreon in Heaven, which shows
that.
You how popular it was in the United States, because everybody realized what that was, and they were basically cranking those out and handing them out on street corners in Baltimore City. About a month later, it was finally published with the actual musical notes and was extremely popular all over the country.
I would think so. I was just thinking of when I listened to the Star-Spangled Banner, being a baseball player, I can't help but I went to a game in Baltimore one time, and every time when they come to the verse at the end where it's "Oh, say," they always yell out "Oh," as
yes.
part of their tradition, I think. But wouldn't it be great if we could get back into the schools and teach this song so that our next generation, following generations, would understand what it really was all about? Because right now it's kind of a song that you sing and everybody yells "play ball."
Yeah, I think there are two answers to that question. The first is I absolutely agree with you. And one thing we do at Fort McHenry is try to help visitors see that it's not just one verse, but four. And they're very powerful, and especially Key's last verse, where he gives his formula for future American success. And the second answer to that question is, you know, I think Americans, they love the national anthem. They're very emotional about it, and yet they don't really know it. You know, beyond "Oh, Say, Can You See?" But they'll stand up and they'll put their hand over their heart and they'll, you know, you get tears in your eyes, because it has transcended that moment from 1814. It's come to represent anything and everything that we believe the United States was, is, or could be. Much like the Iwo Jima photograph, it transcended that moment to the point where, you know, in the last couple of years there have been a lot of books and major motion pictures trying to remind everyone of how that moment came to be, and helping us understand, you know, the individual contribution and lives of those flag raisers. And so that's what we do at Fort McHenry. We just bring it full circle, you know, how that anthem came to be.
Well, we've got about 4 minutes or so up until our next break. And Jim, I want to give you the opportunity to tell us all about your new welcoming center and what's happening at Fort McHenry right now.
Great. Oh, man, it is amazing. It is state-of-the-art. It's brand new. We just opened it March 3rd. There are three major galleries. The first is on the national anthem and the flag over time, how they developed as symbols from the creation of the national anthem all the way up through World War I, World War II, and today. So there's a neat photographic timeline of significant events from, you know, Iwo Jima to 9/11 to the, you know, the miracle on ice in the 1980s to Michael Phelps. He was from Baltimore, singing the national anthem just recently at the Olympics. Another gallery is on Francis Scott Key. You know, who was he? We all know what he wrote, but who is this guy? Why is he downriver with the British fleet? What did he do for a living? What were his religious beliefs? What was his family life like? And so visitors can explore several interactives and learn all they'd ever want to know and more about Francis Scott Key. And part of that exhibit is our brand new live-action movie. It's about 9 minutes long, and it's a huge screen, and it really puts you in the heat of the action. You feel like you're up on the ramparts during the battle or watching the attack from the rooftops of the city, and the response has been really positive. Everybody seems to like the new movie. And then our third gallery is the War of 1812, from the causes through the individual battles of each year on up to the treaty and the lasting impact. So you can spend 20 minutes, you can spend 2 hours and go through these galleries and really gain a new appreciation, I think, for the War of 1812 and that moment in American history. And, of course, the best part of the exhibit, in my opinion, is as you're exiting, you're in a small room. It's dimly lit to protect the document, but there it is, the original handwritten copy of Francis Scott Key's. It's just, it's amazing. It's like going down to Washington and looking at the Declaration or the Constitution.
Well, our audience is all over the country and around the world, and so where exactly is Fort McHenry?
We're located on the tip of Locust Point Peninsula in Baltimore City, Maryland. 8 miles up the Tapsco River from the Chesapeake Bay. Charm City, as they like to call it.
Yeah, Charm City Cakes, right?
Yeah, exactly. Charm City Cakes. We're known for our Natty Bow and our steamed blue crabs and Fort McHenry.
Well, it sounds
it's a great city to visit. It's beautiful.
It sounds like a great place to come down and visit. For those of you out there that are going to be on the road this summer, here's an opportunity for you to find out what our history really is. It's a lot more than many of us realize or remember. And I think it's a great opportunity. Jim, I'm going to ask you to stay on the line after
sure.
I take our break. We're going to be coming back in just a moment with another version of the Star Spangled Banner. And we're going to play just a little brief part of it. And then we're going to talk with the singer of that, Teresa Sloat. So I'm going to ask you to hang on there. All of the opinions and things that we talk about here on Veterans Radio are not necessarily all of those of Veterans Radio or the station that you're listening to for this program. We're going to be back in just a moment, and you are listening to Veterans Radio. We will be right back.
Veterans, need help with your VA benefit claim? Then call Legal Help for Veterans right now at 800-693-4800. To ensure the best possible chance for success, our attorneys at Legal Help for Veterans are devoted to VA claim appeals, and they will forcefully present your particular case. So make that call today to Legal Help for Veterans at 800-693-4800 for your no-charge consultation.
You have honorably served the United States and the Marine Corps in times of peace and war. Now we would like to serve you. The Marine Scholars Program covers the total cost of attending Ave Maria University. By combining resources from the Ave Maria University Marine Scholars Funding, federal financial aid entitlements, and the GI Bill, the benefits are granted for the duration of the recipient's study at Ave Maria University, contingent upon good conduct and good academic standing. The Marine Scholars Program is open to all reserve and active component Marines and other combat veterans of Operation Enduring Freedom and Operation Iraqi Freedom who have honorably served our country. Please visit us online at www.avemaria.edu or call the Assistant Director of Admissions at 239-280-2552. You helped us. Now let us help you. Semper Fi.
Oh, so proudly we hail.
And we are back on Veterans Radio, and that haunting version of the Star Spangled Banner is sung by a friend of ours, Teresa Slotin. Teresa, welcome back to Veterans Radio.
Dale, it's so good to be back with you, and I really appreciated listening to your interview with Jim. Is he still with us?
Yes, he is.
Hello, Jim.
Hi, Teresa. How are you this morning?
Oh, I am reminded of the time that I had the opportunity to visit Fort McHenry in 2007, and just standing, you know, in her barracks and marveling at her beautiful flag and the massive size of those cannons, and yet I was also aware of the just that plot of earth and its vulnerable position over the bay. It's just every American should go to Fort McHenry to appreciate where suffering met sacrifice. And
I agree. Dale, you got to come out here and check out Fort McHenry, too.
I will, and you can tell Roger I'll be there sometime this summer.
I will.
We'll do that. But I brought Teresa on, obviously, because of this haunting version of the Star Spangled Banner, Teresa. And can you tell me a little bit of the background of how you did this or why you did this?
Well, I produced a short film in May of 2001 titled Still There, that our flag was still there. And I created a story about a young woman who wanted to have an impact and reach out to her father figure in the way of her uncle Vito, who owns an Italian supper club in New York City. She knows that he's a Korean War veteran and he keeps to himself. And on Veterans Day, she goes to his little supper club and she asks if he still has contacts at Yankee Stadium. And he says, I sure do. Why do you want to know this? And she says, because I know someone who can sing the stripes off the Star Spangled Banner. And this sets up a relationship where she tries to reach him through the vehicle of her interpretation of what took place, as Jim was saying, in that profound moment of truth and how it's all revealed to us in the words that Francis Scott Key penned. So she begins with, she says to her uncle, you know, if you ask most people, you know, what is the first word to the national anthem, they'll tell you, oh, say, can you see? And it's all run together because that's how they've all mostly heard it. But if you think about it, it's a little word with a lot of meanings.
Mm-hmm.
And she goes into describing what the O meant to her, or what, well, actually, she says, I asked the Lord to give me a vision so that I might have a better understanding, and I got one. And her uncle says, what do you mean? What did you see? And she begins to describe by first saying, I put my hand to the ground, and I was looking to the left and my right, and I saw a trench. And he says, you saw what? She says, a trench. And in the trench were soldiers, hundreds of them lying there in the cold and dark. And they were hungry, and they were scared, and they were bleeding. And then I heard this sound, unlike anything I'd ever heard before in my life. And he says, what is it? What did you hear? And she begins to try to recant for him what you heard in the beginning of the song on that recorded version, which is this otherworldly, agonizing sound. And she returns to her uncle, and she says, it was their agony, their uncertainty. So in the writing of the short film, as I said, titled Still There, it was my desire to put the listener, as well as myself, in the moment of what was happening in the defense of Fort McHenry. What did Scott Key hear as well as see? And I know for certain that he heard the sounds of his countrymen as they lay dying. And I've always felt that if the singer isn't put in that spirit of sacrifice on that earth first, they can't get to that second moment or the third or the fourth or the fifth or the sixth and so on. So it is my desire as an anthem singer to find myself rooted in that sacrifice and in that suffering before the lyric is born through the vocal rendition. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. It makes perfect sense to me. And actually, we're going to go out of the program today by listening to the entire version of Teresa's version of the Star Spangled Banner. And I want our audience to really to pay attention to that, because I think it's going to be so memorable for you. If people wanted to get a copy of that, of this version, Teresa, where would they go for that?
The website would probably be best, stilltherethemovie.com.
Stilltherethemovie.com, and there's a version that they can download from there?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. I think that's terrific. Jim, we've got about a minute left. Is there anything you'd like to add or tell us a little bit more about Fort McHenry?
As Teresa said, it's an amazing place to come, and it's a spiritual experience when you're walking those ramparts and the words of the anthem start going through your mind. I mean, it roots you in a specific time at a specific place, and I don't think anybody that's ever visited Fort McHenry has ever listened to the national anthem in the same way. It just forever changes the way that you look at the flag and the feelings that you have when you hear those notes.
It's really, if you don't mind my interjecting this, it really for me has become a prayer. And when you stand in the barracks and you see the, like I said, the vulnerability, I have a picture of myself with Paul. Do you know who Paul is? I think he's been there like 20-some-odd years.
Ranger Paul Plowman, yeah, he's been here for over 41 years.
That's right, and I gave Paul a copy of my short film, An Anthem, and sat with him in that barrack, and I just, you simply must go experience this church that's on the plot of land called Fort McHenry.
Okay, we're going to go and listen to Teresa's song. Jim, Teresa, thank you so very much for being on Veterans Radio, and we'll be back next week. And until then, everybody, you are dismissed.
Heaven rescued land. Praise the